So this morning, as we come to the end of our series on the life of David in 1 and 2 Samuel, we are going to hear about David's life from a slightly different perspective, the perspective of Joab, his prime commander and also his nephew. And so, as Garth suggested, it is a dramatic presentation, but it's totally based on historical and scriptural data, just reminding us again that God can speak to us through his word in powerful ways that apply to our lives.
So, as we hear from Joab, may we see the contrast between Joab's striving and David's faith in God. May we listen for the ways that Joab's thoughts and feelings resonate with our own, whether for good or bad. And may we be attentive to our King Jesus and willing to surrender even the most difficult parts of our lives to his control.
So we're going to enter our story today at the beginning of 1 Kings chapter 2. And it says, when the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon, his son.
Now you yourself know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me, what he did to the two commanders of Israel's army, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether. He killed them, shedding their blood in peacetime as if in battle. And with that blood, he stained the belt around his waist and the sandals on his feet. Deal with him according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to the grave in peace.
When the news reached Joab, he fled to the tent of Yahweh, and he took hold of the horns of the altar. King Solomon was told that Joab had fled to the tent of Yahweh and was beside the altar. Then Solomon ordered Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, go, strike him down.
So Benaiah entered the tent of Yahweh and yelled to Joab, the king says, come out. But Joab answered,
no, I will die here. You hear me, Benaiah?
Oh, come on, you don't tell me you're afraid to join me here in the tabernacle of Yahweh. You mean to tell me that you're captain of the king's bodyguard? You're a member of the Shelishim, the elite 30 fighting men? But you're not man enough to join me here? Challenge me beneath the altar to Yahweh? Superstitious twerp. Oh, pardon me. I didn't mean to make a mess of the tabernacle courtyard, as the great and pious King David used to love to sing. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Almighty Yahweh. For my soul longs, yes, it even faints for your courtyard. Sorry, I suppose my sarcasm is wasted on the good priests of Yahweh. Never you mind. You'll just have to put up with me for a short time while I claim sanctuary here beneath the horns of the altar. Our new and beloved King of Peace and Wisdom has to make up his pretty little mind about whether or not to run me through. But don't worry, there will be no bloodshed today. After all, Solomon granted sanctuary to Adonijah in the same way before Adonijah made his foolish request. That little privileged brat will figure things out pretty quickly. He'll realize he's dealing with General Joab. He'll give me a wide berth and back off, just like his old man learned to do. Oh, you detect a note of disrespect in my voice for the royal family? You probably think you know King David pretty well. Sure, you've heard the legends of the heroic deeds of his youth. You know of his battle with the Gittite giant Goliath. You've heard of his daring exploits while on the run from the murderous King Saul. You even know of the favor that Yahweh showed him, how he was the man according to God's own heart, the one on whom God had his heart set. Some of you are probably even old enough to remember that hit psalm that was real popular back in the day. You know the one. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his? Yeah, it's catchy. Well, David had a great public image, I'll give him that. But you didn't know the other side of the king. You didn't know the king like those closest to him. You didn't know the frustration of his passivity and indecision, his ungratefulness, his disregard for others. You didn't know the betrayal and humiliation of being treated like a criminal when you were laying down your life for him. You didn't know David like his own family did. You see, you rightly recognize me as Joab, former commander of the armies of Israel and right hand to King David himself. But when I first met David, I was merely Joab, the son of Zeruiah, my mother, who was the oldest sister of David. That's right. I am David's nephew. I was raised as the middle of three boys born to our mother after our father died. The world was a tough place, but mother made us tougher. Anytime Abishai, Azahel, and I would stubbornly insist on our own way or mercilessly wrestle one another unconscious or do anything otherwise risky or ruthless, people who knew our family would say the same thing. There they go again, those sons of Zeruiah. Our mother raised us to be warriors because she was an Ezer, a warrior in her own right. She had to be. King David, on the other hand, or Uncle David, as I knew him, was the youngest of my uncles and the baby of the family, and he was a softy by comparison. He milked being the baby of the family for all it was worth. I remember he used to sit out in the desert outside of Bethlehem for hours at night, singing and writing psalms. I know, it's as embarrassing as it sounds. I'd like to say it got better as David got older, but unfortunately not. And let me tell you, there's nothing more pathetic than watching a grown, bearded man playing a stringed instrument and singing hymns. I guess David wasn't a complete wimp. There was that time when Azahel and David and I were out guarding the sheep in the countryside. We all fell asleep for some reason at the same time that night, but when we woke up, we found that a lion had happened upon our campsite. It was trying to make off with some of the young lambs. I immediately stood up and tried to run the other direction to distract the lion and draw its attention away, but I tripped and fell in the desert sand. I thought for sure I was a goner as the lion changed targets. The next thing that happened astounded me. David leaped forward, he grabbed the lion by its mane, and he clubbed it, until finally it dropped dead. When I recovered from my disbelief, I asked David, how did he do it? David just shrugged his shoulders and said, Yahweh helped me. Yeah, right. David was always doing that. He was always religious, always spiritualizing everything. I'm much more practical. Clearly, there was something about David that was a little unusual, whether it was an extraordinary amount of bravery or some temporary insanity. In any case, I decided to stick with David and see how things would turn out for him. As you know, things turned out pretty well for David. Mind you, after that, I was usually the one that looked out for him after the lion incident. Yeah, in fact, that's because David knew who I was. He knew that I'm a company man, that you won't find a more skilled, dependable, brave soldier. For a long time, David did know that. I was by his side, even back when he was on the run from King Saul, from the cave of Adullam on. Don't think, though, that my loyalty to David was based on some pious faith in Yahweh or devotion to his anointed one. No, my motives were much more simple than that. Our mother raised us to be loyal to family and to tribe. After David became king, sure, the tribe of Judah became representative for the whole nation. But still, my priorities were just as simple. Honor my blood, honor my tribe. And you'd think that with a code of honor that simple, people would understand my actions, wouldn't be surprised by the steps that I have to take to carry out my duties. You'd think that David would be grateful for the ways that my loyalty always worked out in his favor. But no, instead, my code of honor is the reason that David ordered my execution on his deathbed. Can you imagine? He was angry that I brought justice to murderers. He was angry that I put down political opponents, that I took out threats to his throne. And of all the lowlifes that I brought to justice, the worst of the bunch was Abner, the commander of Saul's army. For starters, after Saul died, Abner decided he would obstruct David's path to the throne by supporting one of Saul's sons as the next king. That obviously couldn't be tolerated. So I remember the day that I first made contact with Abner and his men. I decided to release some of the tension between us by proposing a little light entertainment, a friendly match between our best men. I thought it was a good idea at the time, but the men were a little trigger-happy and things got ugly real quickly. I have to say, though, it is quite exhilarating to watch grown, brave warriors fighting to the death at your command. Well, the bloodshed quickly turned into a skirmish and then into a foot chase after Abner. My younger brother, Azahel, was the fastest man in the army. He was quick as a gazelle. He took off after Abner, and I knew the man didn't stand a chance. That is, until Abner cruelly slaughtered my little brother without hardly a warning. Oh, my dear, sweet Azahel, what would my mother have said? I let my little brother be lost. My armor bearers and I gave Azahel the funeral of a warrior. We buried him outside of Bethlehem in the tomb of my mother and father. And then I knew what I had to do. I knew that I had to make Abner pay. Forget that David had offered him a full pardon, that they had made peace with one another. I had to make Abner feel the same shock and horror that he had made my dear brother feel. So, I caught him when he was least expecting it. I made an appointment with him that I knew his ego could not refuse. The commander of Israel's armies wants to consult with me? How flattering. And then I ended him. David wasn't too happy. In fact, David made a point of letting everyone know that the order hadn't been given by him. I even heard when David found out, he cursed me and my entire family. Did David ever bring it up to me, to my face? Did he ever confront me about it? Of course not. He never did. David was never very good at confronting those closest to him. But you want to know the worst part of that day? The worst part was not having to hold my little brother as he took his last struggling breaths. The worst part was not having to take the life of Abner in cold vengeance. The worst part was not even being cursed by the king. The worst part was what David did next. He tore his clothes. He put on sackcloth. He composed a lament psalm for my sworn enemy. He led the funeral procession for my brother's murderer. What kind of man does that for a dangerous opponent? What kind of person treats their political opponent with such honor? Could not understand it. And that was not the last time that David's soft side turned him into a blubbering baby when duty called. And who was always there to rescue the king when he couldn't rescue the nation? Faithful old Joab, that's who. I was there when the king wouldn't wake out of his stupor about the child he'd had with Bathsheba that died. After months of heavy fighting and many heavy losses, our armies were poised to take the Ammonites' capital city of Rabbah. My men and I had fully earned the right to claim credit for victory. But instead of advancing, I sent word to David. I knew that he needed to claim this military victory in order to retain the trust of the army and the people. He had to snap out of his pity party and do his duty. I made David. He needed me. And you know what? It felt pretty nice to be needed. Years later, when David was in shambles about the exile of his rebellious son Absalom, I was the one who orchestrated that visit from the woman of Tekoa to convince David to bring Absalom back. And not too long after that, 2 years later, when Absalom was still under house arrest, David wouldn't talk to him. Whose barley field do you think Absalom set on fire to get an appointment with the king? That's right, my barley field. I bent over backwards for the royal family. I sacrificed the spotlight again and again for the good of the throne and the nation. Now don't think I'm going to sit around and be treated like some pawn of this child King Solomon who's not even 20 years old. Well, then there was that whole business with Absalom himself. You know, that day has always been a bit of a blur to me. We ran around in circles in that God-forsaken forest for hours, half the time jumping at the sight of our own men. We used to say the forest claimed more lives that day than the sword. Sometimes I wonder if, in all the confusion, if I should have spared Absalom's life. Maybe I acted too fast. He should have stood a fair trial. But no, no, no. The kingdom was crumbling in David's hands. Half of all of Israel had already abandoned him to follow Absalom. And the only tribe that remained loyal to David was Judah. I couldn't sit there and do nothing. David thought that somehow Yahweh had a hand in all of it, that we were just supposed to sit by the sidelines and not act. I knew what I had to do. I was a soldier at the end of the day. I did my duty. I did what I had to do. David sang a lament that day that was unlike any other. You know, sometimes I think David took too seriously that line from the song of Hannah, the mother of Samuel. Sure, I believe it's true that Yahweh gives power to his king. He increases the strength of his anointed one. But is it really true that Yahweh lifts the poor from the dust? That he raises the needy from the heap of garbage? Is it true that Yahweh places the poor among princes? That he puts them in seats of honor? Not in the world I'm a part of. In the real world, no matter how awful you feel, no matter how heartbroken you are, you don't get anything handed to you. You have to fight to get to the top or die trying. How do you think David got to be where he was? How do you think he became the first chief to unite the tribes of Israel? He had men like Joab and Abishai fighting for him. He had the elite 30, the Shelishim, the mighty men. Heavens, he even had Benaiah. Hard decisions had to be made. Battles had to be fought. Blood had to be shed. Sure, as the stories go, Hannah could sit for hours and cry out to Yahweh. She could compose lament psalms and pour out her heart. But you can't do that when you're king. When you have people depending on you, you can't be consulting some absent, disinterested God. When you have real power, real tasks to accomplish, you can't spend your time on daily devotions. So I told David as much. I painted him a picture of what things would look like if he didn't shape up and act like a king. No one would be left following him. No one wants to follow a weeping and wounded warrior. No one could put their trust in a suffering sovereign. So what did David do when he finally woke up out of his slump? You can probably guess it by now. David thanked me by firing me and promoting Amasa, my own cousin, to my post as general. That twerp was hardly battle ready, and he didn't have the guts or the brains to rally Israel's fighting men and extinguish the rebellion of Sheba. Now you remember Sheba. After Absalom died, he decided to keep the rebellion alive and gathered as much of Israel as he could. He fled to the city of Abel-Beth-Maacah and holed himself up there. And so, when David didn't respond, I did what I do best. I tracked down my cousin Amasa. I went in to greet him as cousins do. After all, it had been quite a while since we'd had a family reunion for the house of Jesse. And the next thing Amasa knew, he was taking his last breath, lying face down in the ditch. And as fortune would have it, I had been reinstated to my post as general. Well, you can imagine after that, I took care of that rebel scum problem. I was ready to crush the entire city of Abelbeth Maca in order to flush Sheba out. But then a helpful woman at the wall offered to arrange to have him delivered to me, or at least what was left of him. You see, the moment that Sheba thought there was anywhere he could hide from me was the moment he lost his head. The wise woman and good people of Abelbeth Maca just made it official. Well, David didn't give me credit for that victory either. In fact, in his final speech before he died, he didn't even mention my years and decades of faithful service to the royal family. In fact, David credited all the victories, all the success of his kingdom to righteous government and this special covenant that Yahweh had supposedly made with him. Righteous government, my boot. Everyone knew that there was plenty of bloodshed and raging temper and pride throughout David's reign. There was plenty of dirty deeds to go around. One of the most difficult orders I'd ever had to obey was only to cover up a stupid, stupid decision by David. Oh, don't tell me you think that it was only a coincidence that Uriah the Hittite was killed in battle just months before his widow Bathsheba remarried David and bore him a son? Oh, you think that Uriah's death was the result of a strategic error? Joab doesn't make strategic errors. How could David have been so stupid? I mean, what person doesn't covet their neighbor's husband or wife once in a while? It's fine as long as you don't act on it. But David chose Bathsheba. Bathsheba? You remember David's friend and advisor, Ahithophel? Yeah, Bathsheba was his granddaughter. I mean, come on, David. It's no wonder Ahithophel joined Absalom's rebellion against you, you creep. And that's not to mention David's repeated passivity in the face of injustice and threats to the nation, or that horrible decision to take a census of the army that cost so many lives unnecessarily. I couldn't imagine how he could be so stupid. Well, I was at least counting on Adonijah to be the better of two evils. I thought even if Adonijah, you know, isn't very smart, isn't very politically savvy, he's known to make some impulsive decisions, but it's better than Solomon. That is until Solomon messed everything up. You know, I just don't know how we're supposed to respect this Solomon, this king of peace. How are other nations around us going to respect us? We'll become a laughingstock. You're trying to tell me that this boy is going to have a throne that's established forever? That our enemies will be defeated and Israel will experience eternal rest through a peacemaker? Let me tell you, I've had decades of experience in this field. And we need stronger armies. We need bigger walls. Not negotiators, not nonviolent delegations. We need weapons and warriors, not some prince of peace. You know, Yahweh, if you really dwell there behind the great curtain above the mercy seat, if you really expect me to trust you, then stick to what you know. I'll come to your Sabbaths. I'll bring the sacrifices. I'll pay the tithes. Don't get me wrong. I really respect your pious priests. They put on such a great production. They do great ministry for us, for everyday folks like me. That's why a portion of our sacrifices puts food on their table. But do the rest of us a favor. Stay out of my place of work. Stay out of my politics. Let me do my job the way I know best and protect my own. From the looks of it, Benaiah's finally got up the courage to come back here and face me. So I'll show you and you what a real warrior really looks like. And another thing, David may have trusted in you for victory, Yahweh, but I know how I win my battles. My resources, my strength, my will, my skills. David may have consulted you for guidance and direction, but I charted my own course in life, and it worked out pretty well for me. Thank you very much. David somehow believed that you would bring justice in some final day. But the only judgments I've ever been able to rely on are the ones my sword can deal out. David may have lived and died on your terms, Yahweh, but today I live or die on mine. Benaiah!
Then King Solomon commanded Benaiah, "Do as Joab says, strike him down and bury him, and so clear me and my whole family of the guilt of the innocent blood that Joab shed. Yahweh will repay him for the blood he shed, because without my father David knowing it, Joab attacked two men and killed them with the sword. Both of them, Abner and Amasa, were better men and more upright than Joab. May the guilt of their blood rest on the head of Joab and his descendants forever. But on David and his descendants, his house and his throne, may there be Yahweh's peace forever."